What if you had perfect memory? Would it make you into a superhero? Or would it ruin your life? Now, using a number of next-gen AI technologies, perfect memory is not a pipe dream. It's really around the corner. Rewind.ai just raised their Series A at a valuation of $350 million. Investors include Andreessen Horowitz, Reddit's Alexis Ohanian, and OpenAI's Sam Altman. Rewind sits on your computer and phone and watches everything you do. Then you can ask it questions like, what was that really great Mediterranean recipe I looked at last month? Or, I've got a call with a client next week. Can you summarize every interaction we've had up until now? But here's where it becomes even weirder. They've announced the Rewind Pendant, a small audio recorder that sits on your chest. Rewind will be able to listen in to every conversation you have, online and in person. You'll be able to ask it, what birthday present should I get for my partner? Did they drop any hints? Or how many arguments did we have last year? How does that compare to this year? Pretty Black Mirror, right? Once you get over the ick, however, you realize that this is correcting a lagging human function, our imperfect memories. Just like the cursed amongst us wear glasses, tools like Rewind will repair our broken memory systems. I spoke to Dan, Rewind's founder. So Dan, you were director of analytics on the Obama campaign, which famously was one of the first US presidential campaigns to really harness data. And it's kind of the secret sauce, right? Can you talk to me a little bit about what you took away from that? And in particular, the tension between, okay, let's listen to data here when we're making a product, but also that kind of gut instinct and founder knows best mentality. How do you marry the two?
Yeah, the Obama campaign in 2007, 2008 very much felt like a startup. So there was definitely that sort of esprit de corps and the kind of closeness, especially when I joined back in November 2007. Barack Obama was then third in the polls behind Hillary Clinton and John Edwards. And so everyone who was at that campaign was really there because they believed in the candidate, not because they thought he could win, but because they really believed in him and wanted to, you know, for me, it was a question of just, would I rather give it a shot? And if he failed and didn't make it, would I regret that more? Would I stay on the sidelines and regret that? So that's why I did the campaign. And what I learned was this risk-reward mentality. David Plouffe, the campaign manager, coined that phrase. It's the risk-reward mentality, which is this idea that if we did everything that everyone else did, we would end up how everyone expected, third. And so to actually make some decisions that broke the norms were kind of expected. And that's why we actually did this crazy thing called A-B testing, which was actually not at all that crazy in the private sector. I'd seen it up close and personal at Google. In many ways, Google is built, and Google search and ads are all kind of fundamentally built on this concept of A-B testing. But I just brought that concept to the campaign, and a lot of the decisions we would make actually were using data to inform them, which is a pretty abnormal way for political campaigns. Typically, campaigns decisions, important decisions, get made by the person with the grizzled veteran with the white hair, smoking a cigar in the room. It's not this analytical, data driven approach, and turned out to work out really well.
So A-B testing is fundamentally similar to a randomized controlled trial, right? And the problem, and we see this in pharmaceuticals, right, is that an RCT or an A-B test is like a hammer. So it's a great tool, but you need to use it in the right context and you need to ask the right context or give it the right sort of question. Have you noticed that when you're applying that mentality to building Rewind or other products that you've built, that you have to be a bit sensible about how you're applying it? Because I mean, the classic Google example given is that Google experimented with something like 70 or 100 different variations of the shade of blue for their homepage for the hyperlinks, right? And that kind of thing might set you down the wrong path, or you might end up wasting a lot of time on the inconsequential. So broadly, the question is, have you noticed that, okay, this is a great technique, but you need to be sensible with how you apply it as well?
Absolutely. I've written a book about A-B testing, and a big part of that book is trying to teach people that it isn't a panacea. And it's also not a solution to every problem. A lot of the times I like to talk to, when I was running Optimizely, I used to tell CMOs and other executives that their job is to ask the right questions, not to have all the answers. A lot of CMOs think, chief marketing officers think that their job is to like have the great tagline or sort of have no intuition around the market. But really, as a leader of an organization, both a small startup and a big executive, your job is to ask the right questions. And A-B testing and randomized controlled trials are really a great way to get an answer to those questions. But it starts with a hypothesis. You need a hypothesis that's rooted often in some intuition. And the best, you know, the best examples of A-B tests and experiments are when you run the experiment, you had an intuition, and you realize that your intuition was wrong. You know, it's usually, it's the most breakthrough experiments aren't the ones where you like validate your existing hunch. It's when you learn something new about the world and you use that intuition to inform that exploration. So that's the same way I view, you know, both A-B testing on, you know, marketing and websites, but also kind of as a startup. At the end of the day, as a startup, you are navigating this foggy world that you're in. You can imagine it sort of climbing a hill, and you don't see perfectly how to get to the summit, but you know that every step you take, as long as you keep moving, helps you understand better what the topography looks like. And you might go down one path and you learn and you iterate and you put it out in front of users or customers or patients, and you learn it doesn't work, and you come back and you go back a different path. And ultimately, you know, at the end of the day, as long as you don't give up and you keep going and you keep learning, you will eventually get to the summit. So that's the thing I've learned, I think I've seen universally through my experience at Google, at the campaign, and now at Rewind.
When you're building something as disruptive, and to some people, you know, there's a bit of an ick factor, right? It's like when Airbnb first came out, like, well, I'm going to have strangers staying in my house. I'm guessing you have to be a little bit careful with what kind of data or opinions and focus groups you collect from people, right? It's like the famous Henry Ford quote, you know, if I asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. Have you had to temper and just follow your gut at times with Rewind and just not listen to consensus belief?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best book I've read on this topic is called The Mom Test. It's a book that helps you talk to your customers because in a way where you get the truth. Because your customers are lying to you. You know, if you went to your customers and said, hey, I've built this product called, you know, here's my demo, here's my product, what do you think? You're never going to get an honest answer. People want to, you know, they don't want to hurt your feelings. They don't want to hurt your ego. And so, you know, navigating this mountain that I, this metaphorical mountain of building something in the world is in many ways kind of that exploration of learning from customers and building intuition around where to focus and where not to focus. So, you know, I have had times where I had to just listen to my intuition, and that leads us down a path that is unpopular. And I've actually had for better or worse, more times than not, when I go past, against the grain, I've turned out to be right, which I think is not a good feedback loop. You know, I'm probably going to make a bunch of dumb decisions because of that. But, you know, good examples of that is we raised our Series A in public. You know, we put a pitch deck out 7 minutes on Twitter, went viral, millions of people saw it. We got thousands of offers to invest, ended up with a great term sheet and $350 million valuation. And even that first idea of putting that pitch deck out public, it wasn't a consensus good idea. A lot of startups don't do that. More recently, I published my all of my 360 performance reviews. Every quarter, we do 360s at Rewind, focused on how we live up to our cultural values. And I put that out there publicly. Most CEOs wouldn't have the courage to do that. And I guess I've just been rewarded time and time again, especially when it comes to transparency, that, you know, going against the grain and following your intuition leads back to that Obama campaign risk reward mentality. The reward has been there, so I'll keep doing it.
Dan, I'm sorry because you've been asked this to death, but what is your response to the sort of what might be termed not Luddite, but sort of ickiness of the whole Rewind, of being recorded, of having all of this stuff documented and made searchable? There is a real privacy concern, right? And I know a lot of people, I've seen you on like a number of podcasts with different hosts, and they've not been sort of very positive about it. They think it shouldn't exist. Like, how have you responded to that real privacy concern that you are recording people potentially without their consent, and how have you managed that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start by saying that privacy is an important thing to be concerned about. And so I'm actually really happy that people are asking these questions, because I think that's going to force us and our competitors to really get it right. You know, one of the things that you can see, if you look at the history of technology, most new technology goes through these sort of four stages of evolution. You know, they start off with people are surprised or they're shocked. Then they're in awe. How is it impossible? And then they get to the stage of fear. You know, could this kill me? And eventually it comes to the state of being accepted. I've sort of coined this acronym SAFE, you know, shock, awe, fear, expected. And if you think about in this acronym, there are so many examples in the history of technology, from electricity to airplanes to self-driving cars to rewind, where these technologies, because they're so new and so different, rightly people react with concern. And so I think it behooves companies like us to really get it right from the beginning, to really not make privacy a trade-off with convenience, to have a product that is privacy first and delivers the value of this technology. So how are we doing that specifically? Well, we see the product that we're building today as a personalized AI. It is not a covert surveillance or recording tool. It is at its core a product for individual users. It's a product for you to have better memory, to be able to go back to any moment in your past, to use that to live a more productive, more present life, because that AI can help you do things you'd otherwise spend your time on. And indirectly, if there are things that you want to capture around your world, the conversations you have with others, we have tools to make that easy for you to do and also respect the privacy of others. So that's the sort of foundation. And then we have some specific features that we're contemplating that I think will really make a big difference for the pendant in particular, which is a wearable. One example of a feature that we have that we're excited about is the idea of voice fingerprinting and speaker diarization. So if you and I are having a conversation and it's being recorded by the Rewind pendant, everything I say, because I've opted in and it's my device, is captured. Until you say the phrase, yes, I'm okay being recorded, everything you say is ignored. It's basically as if it didn't happen. And that's possible through, as I said, voice fingerprinting and speaker diarization. That's one of the many examples of how technology can give you the benefit of the convenience, of the power, without the trade-off on the privacy.
And are the original voice recordings stored anywhere?
Well, that's we're actually contemplating not storing them. Right now they are for the purposes of summarization. There's a good product that just came out from Zoom called Zoom AI, which tries to strike the right balance of giving you the benefit of Zoom meetings or recordings without the verbatim recordings. And interestingly enough, they launched without transcripts. It generates obviously a transcript, but at the end of the day, you get a summary. And that actually strikes a pretty good balance, because what you get from that is you get the content of the meeting. But if in the meeting you say something that you might regret or you're worried might get you canceled, you kind of have the ultimate plausible deniability. Like, there's no recording, there's no transcript of what you say. So we think that approach could actually work really well for a product like the pendant as well.
I was thinking about this, and I do apologize because my thoughts aren't going to be as developed as yours, obviously. But one of the things I was thinking is that in a normal physiological state or a normal human behavior, we have our memory. And I've heard you quote that you forget something like 90% of your memories after a week, right? So that's the normal state of affairs. In the middle then, I listened to this podcast called The Rest is Politics, and there's a very famous British politician called Alistair Campbell. And throughout his political career, he's been taking very detailed diaries where every day he would write down exactly what happened. And as far as I'm aware, that has actually been, I don't know what the legal term is, but kind of subpoenaed, or it has been brought up as evidence in different situations. And I guess that he didn't take the consent of everyone he spoke to before he wrote down those diaries. But I think people are generally okay with that, because there's a layer of plausible deniability, because it's saying that Alistair claims that I said this, and fair enough, it was written, you know, at the same time, but there's not certainty. Whereas if he'd taken a recording, then that adds an element of certainty. So I do wonder whether the right balance, as you've described with Zoom AI, is keeping that plausible deniability. So this cannot be used against me either in sort of relationships, in social settings, or in legal settings. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there's two points to that. One is, I think having plausible deniability, because what's captured or stored isn't the verbatim transcript recording. I think that's one. The second, which is actually, I think, going to be more prevalent, is the fact that today voice cloning technologies are so good that you literally can create a recording of anyone on the planet saying anything. That already exists today. It's already really good, and it's only going to get better. And you can do it trained on just a few simple sets of words. And when that exists and becomes so prevalent, the chances that you, and then what that does is it creates plausible deniability for anything you've said. You know, any recording of you is just as legitimate as anyone who'd written down what you said, or maybe had been summarized what you said, because it could just have been easily generated through an AI. So I think that might also change norms dramatically as people realize I can't trust anything anyone said. If it's a recording, there's no way to, it's indistinguishable from what an AI could say. And, you know, we're not building that obviously, but others are. And because that will be out there, I think people's sort of temperature and knee-jerk reaction to a recording that feels official and could be used against me, I think that that will actually very quickly go away.
Yeah, I think deep fakes will be a huge boon for you. And another thought experiment I thought of was, you know, if we took, say, human vision, at the moment, we can correct it to basically normal levels if your vision is defective in some way. But if we introduce something like Rewind for human vision, where you can make it super physiological, give you superpowers, and imagine that, you know, I live in a skyscraper right now, I could look across 2 miles away into someone's window and make out perfectly what they were doing, people would have an issue with that, right? And they might react in a very similar way. But maybe in 5 or 10 years, then we start designing skyscrapers so that the windows are tinted, we change how we act. And then once those adaptations had been put into place, everyone would be happy about it. And I wonder with Rewind whether we will eventually have to make some kind of adaptation when things like tools like this do exist, where we're maybe more careful with what we say, or we just assume that we are being recorded unless otherwise explicitly stated. Do you know what I mean? There might need to be that societal change.
Yeah. And I don't think it's societal change writ large. I think there is probably 5 or 10% of society who will have to change their behavior. And I think those people probably should change their behavior. I operate under the assumption everything I say is recorded. Anyone could say it or use it. I don't ever tell one person one thing and another person a different. I don't lie. I don't gaslight. And it's not because, you know, I have some kind of higher moral characters. I just know at some point, maybe there's a recording, maybe there's not. And I just change the way I interact with the world. There's some people, and they tend to be of the older generation, who don't operate that way. And so, frankly, I think it's good for society. I think it's good for workplaces. I think it's good for avoiding harassment, that if people operated under the assumption that maybe what they're saying is being recorded and potentially they shouldn't say the thing that they would be afraid to have been said, to have been recorded, I think that might be actually good for society.
Yeah, maybe some increased accountability. Although this is always how these things start, where it's like, if you've got nothing to hide, then don't worry about it.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair criticism. I mean, yeah, that's like, you can say that of any kind of privacy invading technology or any kind of surveillance technology. But I think this is different. This is not about the state owning these recordings. This is not about the sort of state persecuting you and sort of Big Brother. You know, this is about two people, one of which wants better memory. They want to have more time with their kids. They don't want to sit there in a meeting taking notes, which is, I think, a legitimate desire and want. And at the same time, they're using a technology that goes and does its best to respect the privacy of others. And I think in a world, I think it's fair to say that the people who want those desires and to live a better, more fulfilled present life shouldn't have to play, the second class to somebody else who's paranoid that something they said that was an off-color joke gets used against them in the future. And again, with deepfakes, I even think that risk goes away as well.
Dan, I said this before to you privately, but I think that Rewind to me looks more like a medical device in the future, right? It seems to me like it's an obvious BCI, brain-computer interface, going into the future that will help so many people who suffer from poor memory for whatever reason, whether that can be like a dementia or it can be a focus problem like in ADHD. Many, many people could be helped. I wanted to hear you sort of spitball on different human senses or human functions that we may be able to repair beyond a physiological level. So for example, one that comes to mind is navigation. We've clearly gone way above what a normal human is able to do with navigation, right? With Google Maps, you can map out an area and look at loads of different routes and find the optimal one, which we could never do before. I think with Rewind, you're doing this with memory. Other senses that come to mind, I don't know if reasoning, if we've improved on that. I don't know with hearing, vision. I don't know where we are with that. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Oh boy, do I have thoughts. And some of these will sound quite crazy. So I'll start with like the things that Rewind does today that are surprisingly, or I should say not by design, beneficial to people who today maybe, have a different, differently abled. You know, one is ADHD. Like, we were very surprised how many people from almost the very first version of our product said how Rewind, as somebody with ADHD, how Rewind gives them the ability to focus again. They can go back. They can be productive members of meetings in society because they can go back. They can retrace their steps. They're not constantly lost. That was a huge surprise to me. And then, now, of course, in hindsight, it makes a lot of sense because the tool that we've provided makes it really easy for them to be just as focused as somebody who doesn't have ADHD. I think, there's also a whole class of people, I'm hearing impaired, I wear a hearing aid, where being able to just capture and recall You know, my wife would be thrilled if I remembered or heard, frankly, and remembered the thing she asked me to grab at the store right before I'm about to go to the shopping market. And so I think there's a whole class of those people. And as I think more broadly, you know, I think a lot of medical professionals think about sort of the normal human condition and then, you know, diseases or people who are sick or they have conditions. But I think when you think of normal, I very strongly believe that we live our lives with blinders. We are not aware of the limitations of our own biology. And only when you have technology that can actually augment and overcome those limitations, can you feel what it's like to be, you know, that's why we say our vision is to give humans superpowers. Because that's what it felt like to lose my hearing and gain it back again. I didn't realize until I tried the hearing aid how bad my hearing had gotten. And only when I got the hearing aid, which was great, I could hear again. But the thing that was even more surprising than being able to hear again was the realization of how bad it had gotten. And I think that's true of memory. You know, it is true that we forget about 90% of what happens after a week, but most people don't think that. Most people don't feel that because they don't know what they don't know. But if you did have a technology that could give you the feeling of remembering everything and never missing a beat and being present in meetings because you don't have to take notes, you can just be there, those are the kinds of feelings that I think can transcend what are normally considered, you know, the limitations of our of a normal person's biology. And so that's something I'm even more excited about than helping people with ailments get to normal, is taking normal and making it super normal, making it so that so we all live a better life because of technology.
Let me make a case against having good memory. So 2 points. One point being that maybe us forgetting things is a useful function in terms of sorting, so that we sort of realize when something's important and we need to remember it, and all the other crap that we go through in life, what color was the sign, you know, in the shop yesterday, we forget that. And that's maybe a good thing. That maybe helps us stop being overwhelmed. Secondly, there is a little bit of research. Someone linked me a paper called Suppression-Induced Forgetting of Unwanted Memories Appears as a Critical Ability to Preserve Mental Health. So maybe there is a bit of a function in terms of forgetting past trauma and sort of moving on, right? And if you did have perfect memory and you can replay all of those all of those childhood bullies, maybe that's not a good thing. What do you kind of think of that?
I strongly disagree. I think that's a bunch of baloney. Because first of all, we're not forcing you to recall these memories. We are giving you the option to go back to those memories. To have the ability to go back is far better than not in almost every circumstance. And in the situations where it's traumatic or you don't, you just delete the recording. We're not forcing you to keep it forever. So I think it's kind of it's maybe a knee-jerk reaction, or maybe dystopian sci-fi from watching too many Black Mirror episodes, where you think that like somehow you'll be haunted by your memories. You know, it's like saying if you could have superhuman strength, like, well, I don't know, because like you might open that can like a little bit too hard and like scratch yourself on the can, you know, like. I don't think there's much merit to it. If you want to forget it, just delete it. We're not forcing you to remember it. But I think it sort of undermines the value you get from remembering things you otherwise would have, given that the vast majority of things you forget, a few of those things might be traumatic. Just delete those from the product. We're not going to, and it's not the kind of thing, it's like this camera that you wear. It's, you know, it's the things you say and the things you hear, and usually in a work setting. So anyway, sorry, I'm not trying to be cavalier. It's just I've heard that, and I think it sort of loses sight of the benefit you get for the few cases where you might want to just delete what you captured in the past.
With Rewind, on a societal level, if say in 5-10 years it turns into a brain computer interface, and say the majority of the population have some form of Rewind or some form of supraphysiological memory, what do you think the societal impacts would be? One quote that comes to mind when discussing immortality is around how people don't like it because they, you know, there's that quote about how society progresses only when our forefathers die, that sort of thing. Like, we don't move forward until the leaders end up dying. That comes to mind with having perfect memory as well. Maybe there's a larger societal function as well of forgetting things. What's your thought there?
I think there's a couple things I would predict. One is I think we would all be much better communicators. The source of a lot of miscommunication comes from misremembering and from sort of selective remembering. So I think communication and commitment and agreement, sort of having impeccable commitments to the people around you, will be dramatically better when you don't forget and you don't misremember the things that were said. So I think that's one. I think that will go a long, long way to resolving conflict, to improving relationships, to improving organizations, is, you know, making better communication, you know, because that's the core of miscommunication. I also think that just because you have the ability to go back and remember doesn't mean that you have, you're not somehow stymied by that in a way that prevents you from coming up with new ideas. I think that happens whether you remember them or not. In some ways, you know, for people who, you know, they say as you get older, you get more stuck in your ways. Like if you remembered your youth, I don't think you would be less stuck in your ways. You know, like you're sort of like, you will remember that. In some ways you might remember, boy, I was pretty adaptable and I could change my mind earlier when I was younger. And boy, I do remember a time when I had an opinion and I changed it with new evidence. Whereas oftentimes the criticism of the older generations is that, you know, even given new information and new evidence, they don't change their ways. So I don't see it in that way. You know, we're not yet working on things like giving, you know, immortality, and but I think those are the things that might certainly have bigger impacts on society than being able to communicate better and be able to remember better.
There's this quote around how you should look at what nerds are doing today, and that will be what everyone else is doing in the future. And Rewind reminds me a lot of that. Another sort of tangentially related industry is around these kinds of knowledge applications like Rome Research, Evernote, Notion, all of these types of Obsidian. And the thing I wanted to ask you is, have you thought about the best way to interact with our past memories? And the reason I ask is because I think Obsidian and Rome use knowledge graphs, which is really interesting, where it's like this spider diagram, this very sci-fi like approach where you're seeing all the nodes connecting and making connections between disparate sort of objects. Another thought is around just using like a simple voice-based, you know, like a Siri, like querying our memory using natural language. What, like, how have you thought around these different approaches?
Yeah, so I'd describe the class of tools you mentioned, starting with Evernote and more recently Notion, and then Rome and Obsidian. They're all kind of in this personal knowledge management category, PKM. Evernote was really a pioneer here and actually really built a following around this idea. Actually, in many ways, the same vision we have of giving humans perfect memory and giving them superpowers. You know, their logo was an elephant. An elephant has great memory. And I think the difference between those tools and our tool, it's not to say that we compete, but the difference is note-taking requires you to actively try to predict or have foresight for what you might want in the future. The challenge is you don't have perfect foresight. You don't know in a meeting what note to take, what note not to take. And there's a common misconception about note-taking. People tend to think, oh, I'll take notes because it'll help me remember better. The misconception is, yes, you will remember the thing you write down, but as you're writing, the thing that's being said immediately after the thing you want to write, you will forget that almost certainly. So your body and your mind can't do those two things at the same time. By taking notes, even by hand or digitally, like with a tool like Obsidian, you are still missing a lot of what's being said because you have to actively take notes. So the fundamental difference is, you know, note-taking is active, requires foresight. Rewind is passive and does not require foresight. So passively captures everything you see, say, and hear. Everything that appears on your screen, including your notes, including, you know, if you have your note-taking open, it will capture that just the same. We capture that, we do optical character recognition on it, we turn it to words that you can store into a database. And only if you need it later, which oftentimes what you need later is the thing that you didn't take notes on, you can actually go back and find it. So it's just a fundamentally different approach to the same problem, which is, you know, trying to be able to remember better, but not requiring you to be as active.
And I completely agree. I think anytime you're trying to, and I come from like the patient perspective on this in terms of if there's any intervention or any monitoring that requires active participation, that's always going to be a struggle because you need that motivation every day. Yeah. It's always best if it's passive collection. So that's, I think, an awesome part of Rewind. Specifically on the part of sort of interfacing and passing through and making novel connections, are there any interesting things you think you could do with Rewind in terms of not only collecting this sort of interesting data, but also being able to make new kind of orthogonal and different connections that we wouldn't be able to as normal human beings?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We're just getting started. It doesn't quite do as much as we think we can in that space. Today, in some ways, you could think of Rewind as capturing a lot, but really understanding a little. You know, we see what's on your screen, but we don't really know the difference between, you know, if you got your email open, we don't know the difference between the content of the email and the sidebar and the email and your browsing. So there's a lot of cruft. And despite that, it still works surprisingly well. But there's a, you know, right now a focus of ours is to create and understand better the things we capture, not just capture it, but understand it. And that's where large language models and, you know, and embeddings, and a lot of these new technologies make it really easy to do that. And we do think, you know, a knowledge graph is certainly something that we've explored and we think will continue to be helpful for in service of this greater power of giving you a personalized AI. But we're starting with the table stakes. Let's capture everything, you know, make it as robust in terms of how we capture. And then, you know, as you can think about this pyramid of sort of data to information, to knowledge, to wisdom, we want to sort of move up this pyramid as we're able to do so using the data that we collect.
Dan, I have no sort of technical expertise, so please do correct me if what I say is garbage. But to me, and from listening to you speak, there seem to be some critical technological leaps that have occurred that have allowed you to exist, right? You couldn't have existed 10 years ago in the same way that you do now. Some of them that you've previously mentioned are the M1 and M2 chip, which allow you to kind of operate discreetly and in the background without kind of blowing up the computer. Another one is LLM technology, ChatGPT-like technology that allows you to query large amounts of data and ask it kind of natural language questions. You have OCR, where it's optical character recognition, where you can read through the screen essentially and tell text. Are there any things that don't exist now that when they do exist will really level up what you're able to do?
Yeah, well, you got that great, by the way. You really you did your homework. That's a fantastic, you got almost every major technological.
I don't understand any of them.
The only thing you missed was automated speech recognition, taking a conversation like this and transcribe it. But everything else is kind of the core way. We stand on the shoulders of giants with M1 and M2 chips from Apple. It really is incredible how we built, what we built, even 2 years ago wouldn't have been possible without that underlying hardware. In particular, the architecture they use is called a system on a chip, where the things that would have otherwise been software in your CPU now has been completely offloaded to a purpose-built piece of hardware. So we are in total debt and gratitude to the engineers of that product. But to answer your question, the big breakthrough that I think will change our product, the ways people think about our product in terms of privacy and every product like ours, is when the ability for machines to offer what currently is, GPT-4, which is the best large language model offered by OpenAI, to offer that entirely locally using a local large language model. Today, the best large language models, Llama 2, and there's some other more recent ones that have come out. The pace of innovation there is staggering. It's amazing how much these are getting better and better. So it's possible that we're on the order of maybe months, maybe a year away from models that are as good and as efficient as GPT-4 is in the cloud as you might have locally. And the reason why it's so powerful is that now a product like Rewind can work entirely locally. You can turn your Wi-Fi off and everything that we do, from asking questions of anything you've seen, said, or heard. Currently, already, everything we are capturing, we store locally. We don't have access to it. If we're subpoenaed by the government, we can't hand anything over because it's all on your machine that we don't have access to. And so when local large language models are feasible, the quality is good, and the performance is good, I think that's going to be a total game changer for our industry.
And the key point around that will also be around privacy, that your recordings or your transcripts or any of your content never leaves your hard drive. It never goes online.
Correct. Yeah, today that's true. None of the recordings ever leave. Sometimes when you do a search with GPT-4, we include some of that context, but just the text of it. But even that alone, if that's all done locally, I think that that creates a much more simple model for people to understand. And by the way, we gave a demo of this a few weeks ago. Intel launched their new Meteor Lake chip called Intra-Core Ultra. And I was lucky enough to be on stage with the CEO of Intel and at their developer conference demoing a local large language model running on the Intel chip with the Wi-Fi off.
Amazing, amazing. Dan, is it not a sort of existential threat if you're using OpenAI's ChatGPT technology that one day they mess around with GPT-4 or they close it off or something else happens and that you are kind of, I think the sort of cynical view of startups that use these technologies is that they're just like a thin wrapper over GPT, right? Is that not like a big issue for you?
Well, I mean, first of all, that part of our product is optional. It's in the cloud. It's optional. It's a nice to have. It's not sort of the core functionality. Right now, you can still browse back and forth in time. You can look at transcripts. You can search those transcripts. And we also integrate with Anthropic. Claude has a great large language model too. So we benefit tremendously from them duking it out. And soon Google will have a good competitor. So we're not entirely, we don't have a ton of platform risk with OpenAI. We're lucky that actually Sam Altman was our first investor, and we've had other co-founders of OpenAI is invested as well. So that helps a little bit as well. But at the end of the day, what we're focused on is sort of solving the problems for our customers, for our users. I think today OpenAI and GPT-4 are fantastic. My guess is it's going to be sooner than you think that you'll be able to do this all locally, which then means you can run it without an internet connection.
Maybe you could explain this to me from a business decision point of view. And that is, I don't understand why you haven't focused in on one specific enterprise or professional use case. What you're doing now is obviously cool and you'll have loads of interested parties who are probably doing great things in and of themselves. But I don't understand why, for example, on the medical side, we have a bridge where it's like a smart companion. It listens to the consultation, summarizes it. Very cool. I think on the law side, I believe it's called Harvey.ai. That's quite a big player in this space. But a lot of the job of a lawyer is essentially sitting there and like summarizing notes and going through them. So why have you decided to go for this general use case and not a specific use case that I imagine would be a lot more lucrative and you'd have people bending over to pay you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's two ways to look at it. I think going after a specific use case, or, you know, as described in sort of tech jargon as a ideal customer profile or a super specific who, going after that is kind of easy mode for startups. You have focus, you have clarity, you have alignment, you have decisiveness. Marketing is easier, product is easier, but you also have a much more narrow market. And I think, you know, in there are some tools that do that and they're fine with that. There's others who view themselves more as utilities, more as a product that can help anyone. And it's harder. I'll admit, it's readily harder. It's harder to decide what to prioritize. You get pulled in lots of different directions. The marketing message on your homepage now needs to appeal to a broader audience. And when you do that, you sometimes lose the edge you could have if you had like the perfect tagline for a doctor. So, you know, we've tried to, you know, come up with what we think is an ideal customer profile. You know, we describe it as people who work at, you know, companies or organizations that are 1 to 50 people. They're typically in the United States. This group of people retain really well for us. These are people who aren't working at large companies where IT is going to be breathing down their neck and paranoid about third-party software. That's where we've seen a lot of success, but even that is a huge, huge group of people. So, you know, that's not to say we won't focus in the future, but right now the answer is we're getting pulled in so many directions and it's hard to say no when we see a lot of market demand in lots of different places.
Speaking of playing on hard mode, so your last startup, Optimizely, by the time you left, I believe it was doing $120 million of recurring revenue. And what I've been told about first-time founders is that they typically go for D2C, direct-to-consumer, and then they become a bit wiser. And then when they found the next company, they go B2B or business-to-business. You've done the opposite switch, so now you've gone direct-to-consumer. What was your thinking behind that? And was it, in, you know, looking back, playing on hard mode?
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely playing on hard mode, but it was by design. You know, like I'm lucky enough that Optimizely did well, that I could swing for the fences with this startup and do things a little bit harder that might have a bigger impact. You know, in the same way that, you know, going after a broad market and now after going to the consumer market, it's hard, but if you get it right, you can touch millions, if not billions of people much faster than you could with a traditional sales force knocking on people's doors. So that's part of it is like, you know, I was appealed to the impact, the potential impact for our product. You know, I would also lie and if I didn't say that I also really didn't love the enterprise B2B game. It's less about the quality of the product and more about, you know, the relationship and more about, you know, the what I felt were kind of like the impure parts of building software. Steve Jobs has a great quote on this. Once somebody asked him kind of similar question, is like, why don't you, you know, go to the enterprise more heavily? And he thought about it for a second and he said something to the effect of he loves his current job. He loves it because when selling to consumers, you wake up in the morning, you go to your job, you do a good job, you try to build a product that you think is good. And if it's good, your users will buy it and you get to go into work the next day. When you sell the enterprise, the buyer of your product is not the user of your product. And oftentimes, the buyer is confused. This is his word. He says they're confused, which is his sort of disparaging way of saying like they're solving for the wrong problems. They're solving, you know, their requirements aren't the actual things that matter to the user. And so like, I just didn't want to be in a business where I'm trying to build for confused buyers. I wanted to be held accountable to building a great product that is so damn good that a human being, an individual person will say, I'll pull out a credit card and pay you money because it's created so much more value in my life than the subscription cost of the product. So it's playing on hard mode, but I'd much rather play on hard mode and win than play on easy mode and win.
Feel free to answer this as generally or as specifically as you want, but what have you learned about leadership and leading a team? And one thing that comes to mind is you seem like quite a nice guy. And I wonder if that's been beneficial or if that's been harmful in different aspects. Because I often ask people I interview, you know, do you need to be a dick to be a good leader? And I think that's quite an interesting approach because it's very like a knee-jerk reaction is, of course you're not. You should always be nice. But I guess the truth lies somewhere in between. What do you think?
Yeah, I've been reflecting on this more and more. I'm about halfway through the Elon Musk biography. I'm listening to his audiobook and sort of makes me reflect on my style. Not to say we should all emulate Elon Musk, but he's got a very unique approach to leadership. You know, I have evolved on this quite a bit in my career. I think when I started, I was still very young. My company grew very quickly at Optimizely and I was hiring people who were twice my age, twice the experience. And I was very deferential. Like I was very much like, my job is to hire people that are better than me, get out of the way, empower them to be successful. And I didn't know how to hold people accountable. I just didn't know how to do that. And so, and I think that's probably rooted in sort of my childhood, my experience not really being able to deal with, understand conflict and being conflict averse. So I've had to sort of rewire myself and overcome a lot of childhood trauma to really understand how to hold people accountable in a productive way. Once I learned those skills, I think I changed a lot as a leader. And I also look at one of the lessons I learned. If I look at the theme of all the things I learned from my last company, 12 years, 120 million in annual revenue, all of the things I regret most fall into this one pattern. I wanted to do A. My gut says we should do A. Somebody else thinks we should do B. A great executive I've hired, a board member, whatever. And we end up doing B and it turns out poorly. There are plenty of times when we did A and it turns out poorly. I don't remember any of them. All I remember are the times when I went against my gut and it turned out poorly. And I know that that was me not holding them accountable. That's me not being courageous and saying, no, I'm the boss. We're going to do it this way. And I'm sure many a times, I'm not saying I'm perfect, but I know that I will regret it less if I'm willing to stick to my conviction and intuition. And that's the thing that I also think as a leader, and then, Elon Musk shows this brilliantly in so many examples where he's just such a sponge for intuition and information that his intuition, even if against somebody who's a grizzled veteran of stainless steel construction, Elon Musk is thinking from first principles. He's thinking outside of the box in unconventional ways. And so I don't think you need to be a jerk, but you do need to be able to stand up for what you believe. You do need to be good at holding people accountable. I think there's some Machiavelli quote around, you need a leader who's both loved and feared at the same time. So I think that's kind of what you need as a combination of both.
I heard you touch on this point. I thought it was really interesting. And it's around you being a second time founder and having a successful past. And of course, that comes with benefits around capital and recruiting team and just experience. But you touched on the negatives and maybe of inflated expectations and perhaps not being able to be as scrappy and make mistakes publicly because you have a reputation now. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I think this is very true of a lot of second-time founders. I certainly felt this a little bit before we launched Rewind the very first time, so over almost a year ago. I feel it less now because we've got traction and we're at momentum. But going from zero to one, from like no one knowing what you're doing to everyone knowing what you're doing, there's a lot of expectations. If you had a prior successful company, first of all, the next time you launch something, you're going to have somebody actually pay attention. It's not a lot of people, but like sometimes you launch as a first-time founder and nobody cares. Nobody pays attention, no matter how good or bad it is. So, you know that you're going to draw, a TechCrunch article and some folks on Twitter are going to talk about it. So that already sort of sets expectations higher. And I also think that people tend to hold themselves to higher expectations. I know I do. Like, I'm proud of Optimizely, but I want, and I think it's still going. I just spoke at the customer conference 10 years ago. It's like acquiring company actually renamed their company to Optimizely. So now that's the whole company is called Optimizely. So I'm proud of that. But my heart of hearts, I want Rewind to have 10 or 100 or 1,000 times the impact. So I think those internal expectations also play a huge role in second-time founders being a little gun-shy to talk about what they're working on.
You've had a really successful career in lots of different areas. And just from my sort of very vague look at your past, it seems like you've been top of the game at everything you've done. And maybe you will agree or disagree with that, but that's how it seems on the outside. And what I wanted to ask was, have there been any common threads or any particular habits or ways you approach things? Because I often think that, if you take all humility aside, when you're doing well at something, you can quite easily see where other people are making mistakes. So when you look around yourself to maybe the person who didn't become director of analytics on the Obama campaign or who didn't, found an amazingly profitable and successful startup, is there anything that you see that you're like, if you'd just done this or if you'd been different like this, you would have done a lot better?
Yeah, there's a couple really foundational things. First of all, I've made a lot of mistakes and I have a lot of screw-ups. I should probably just add them to my LinkedIn profile. They're just not there. They're the things in my LinkedIn profile that were the failures, and I'm happy to talk about them. But the bigger lesson I would say, and the thing that I attribute, if any success I've had, if you consider it success, it's been to approach life as a learn-it-all, not a know-it-all. To treat every opportunity as an opportunity to get better, to never rest on my laurels and never think that I'm good enough, knowing that I could always be better. I think that feedback loop and being willing to take that feedback loop publicly, to go on podcasts and get, ripped a new one and hold myself to the standard of being able to actually, not this one, by the way, another one. Those are things that I think are important for me personally. I think they're good for our business. You know, I try to do that as a manager, as a leader, as a father, you know, as a husband. So I think just having that approach that your job is to do the best you can and accept feedback. A lot of people get blocked and don't realize how defensive they get. You know, it's very hard for somebody who's, especially for me, I'm 40 years old, like I have certain habits, like to break your habits, to stop something that you've been doing your whole life and say to yourself, wow, maybe that served me well when I was younger, maybe not, but it's certainly not serving me now. So let's change. That's very, very hard for people to do. I've done that time and time again. I used to be a meat-eating carnivore and I became now a devout, almost like a proselytizing vegetarian. I used to drink probably more than was healthy. I don't drink anymore. I used to play video games and I don't do that anymore. Like I've learned these things about myself, about my body, about how I interact with the world, about my business. I used to, you know, make up for my lack of prioritization and focus by just working a lot of hours. Now I have three young kids. I have a five-year-old, a three-year-old, and a one-year-old. So I am ruthless with my time. Like if I could take me as a CEO today and put me back 10 years ago, I would be like 10x more productive in the time of hours I had because I just know how to focus on the things that matter and ignore the things that don't. So that would be my biggest lesson is to be a learn-it-all, not a know-it-all.
Could I ask in a very personal sense that you talk about this sort of personality traits that you have or this constellation of symptoms or this particular character you have where you are a learn-it-all rather than a know-it-all. Perhaps that also links to being a little bit more humble and earlier in your career, being a little bit more deferential than was required to do what you needed to do. Was there a point, and I think about this from my own perspective as well, where you had to make a switch, where you had to switch, say, okay, I'm in student mode, I'm in learn-it-all mode, I'm a bit deferential, I'm willing to learn from others a lot, but now I need to switch. Like this is a new game now. Did that happen at some point?
It wasn't a switch, no. I mean, I've had people who I'm very lucky to have interacted with in the world who were models of this. And I think that helped a lot. You know, I got to see what it would look like. And in some ways, I don't think it's deferential. To be a learn-it-all is to be so confident in your skills that you could tell somebody to their face, I don't understand that. Can you explain it to me? I don't know what you mean by that. Here's a dumb question. Those are the things that people who are truly confident would say. It's the people who are maybe a little insecure, who don't actually, you know what they're doing. They're the ones that actually pretend like they know what they're doing. And so in some ways, maybe that's the biggest gift I've had is that I've been lucky to have this confidence in the roles that I've been in where I'm not afraid to ask the dumb questions. And in some ways, I hope that's infectious. Other people see that. I was like, wow, Dan sure asked that dumb question. Maybe I can. Because there's really no dumb question. You know, I think in many times, people sort of put this facade in front of themselves that block them and the people around them from getting better. So I can't think of a particular time. I know there's certain people in my past who have been good models of this, and that's probably helped a lot.
Sure. So a quiet confidence instead of a sort of insecure gregariousness is what's needed. Yeah. The last thing I wanted to ask Dan was around sort of your PR and positioning and marketing element. The interesting thing I've seen is that I don't know if you've done this on purpose, but there's been a lot of controversy created around Rewind. And a lot of the discussion or the interest from people is around the Black Mirror angle, right? It's like, wow, this is so dystopian. This is so fucked up what Dan's doing with his team. Like he's going to ruin the world. And I wondered how you've thought of that. Is that something that you have consciously tried to harness and been like any publicity is good publicity? Or is it something that's accidentally happened and you've been like, oh, this is really bad. This is really bad. What's been your approach?
Well, my thinking on this has evolved. So first of all, it's not at all. It initially was never by design. It was never like, oh, let's put something controversial out there because that'll go viral. It was like an earnestness and a belief that what we were doing is good and a recognition that it is different. Anytime that you do anything different, that changes people's perspective. They raise their eyebrows. They're cynics. So that was kind of inevitable, but it wasn't from a sort of manipulative, let's put something out there like more controversial than it needs to be. It was just like an earnest, like, I actually think this is a good idea. And it wasn't possible before. And just like airplanes sounded scary and just like electricity sounded scary and just like self-driving cars sound scary, like this sounds scary. But eventually you realize that, wow, actually it's not all that bad. And boy, is there so much utility and yeah, how could I live without it? Like, so I recognize it from the beginning. And I think at first, it kind of hurt my feelings, like people describing what we're doing, like a dystopian sci-fi nightmare. And eventually, I came to a level of acceptance when I realized that for every person out there who is quote tweeting our posts saying this is a Black Mirror episode, half of their followers would actually be like, hell no, this is actually super cool. I'm going to sign up. And when I saw that, then I sort of came to peace with, okay, you can't make everyone happy. You're going to have haters. The good news is our haters are willing to sort of spread the gospel about what we're doing. And half of their friends and half of their followers actually think it's a good idea. And so, yeah, it actually does help us. In hindsight, I look back and like, yeah, if we were more middle of the road and more vanilla and more kind of what people were familiar with, then probably people wouldn't talk about it as much. So I wouldn't say you should go out on a mission to create controversy. But if it comes in your lap and it's from a good place and you have an earnest approach that you're trying to do, it's not like the end of the world either, you know. And my hope and my belief and frankly, my prediction is that 5 or 10 years from now, we will look back at some of these tweets and reactions and laugh at how how antiquated it must have seemed back then. Just same way that today, you look back at when the telephone was first invented. You have the president of the United States saying, "Interesting device, but who would ever use this thing?" You have history; it shows time and time again. Any new technology has that pattern. So I hope we follow suit and we'll build just as amazing breakthrough technology as the phone.
I hope you enjoy that episode. You can find all my links by going to bigpicturemedicine.co.uk. And I've got a favor to ask. If you've been enjoying the podcast or you really enjoyed this episode, then just send it to someone, a friend in your life who you think might enjoy it. Just go on WhatsApp, messages, whatever, send them a link. That would be a huge, huge help. Thanks for listening.